controlling. What you see as control, your mother sees as love. She only wants what's... He held up his hand. Don't you dare say it. All right, then, I won't. But tell me, where's your dad in all this? There's no mention of him in the paper. I thought you said your parents threw you out. He wrinkled his nose and shook his head. I don't have a dad, he said bluntly. Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I just... My mum never talks about him. She went on holiday to Brighton when she was 15 and came back with more than a stick of rock. He smiled at her shocked expression. My grandparents practically brought me up. I thought Geraldine was my sister until I was about 10. Even though my grandparents did most of the work, I think my mother missed out on an awful lot of school. She certainly didn't fulfil her own potential. That's why she's always pushed me so hard. She's living vicariously through me, revelling in my achievements as though she's the one who sat the exams. Don't you think she's suffered enough now? Sarah asked quietly. You've made your point, Adam. It's time to do the right thing. For who, though? For everybody. He stayed silent, picking at a loose thread on his jumper. Adam, you know it makes sense. She took hold of his chin again. Look at me. Go home and talk about this like the sensible lad you are. Your mother loves you, and this is killing her. Whatever it is you think she's done, she doesn't deserve this. He clasped his hands together on top of his head. Oh, I don't know. If I go back, it's like admitting I've failed. You haven't failed, she said emphatically. I think you're a fine young man, resourceful, enthusiastic, and intelligent. And the way you've helped me with my research, documenting the cases and everything, well, I would be proud to call you my son. He smiled, reached out, and squeezed her hand. Wish you were my mum, Sarah. You'd make a really great mother. No doubt he meant well, but his words stung. It's probably a bit late for me now, but it's not too late for you. You love your mum, don't you? He shrugged.
Suppose so.
Well then, your relationship needs a hero, Adam. Is that going to be you?
I'm not going back to that school, though. No way. I want to go to the local school with my mates, where the teachers don't mind if you show up chewing gum, where you don't get a lunchtime detention just because your shirt isn't tucked in.
He suddenly sounded like the truculent 15-year-old he really was. Look, I promised my father I would go back to his house. I left in rather a hurry when I saw your photograph on the front page. Come back with me, Adam. We'll get you cleaned up, and then you can call your mum. I'm sure she'll be so glad to have you home, she'll agree to almost anything. Her father was in his dressing gown by the time she arrived back with Adam. Dad, what are you doing dressed for bed at 3 in the afternoon? A damp towel was slung over his shoulders.
I've just had a bath, if it's all right with you.
A bath? Oh, God, I hope you've not used all the hot water. He noticed Adam then, hovering behind her.
Who's this?
This is Adam Clark. Adam, this is my father, Stephen. Adam held out his hand and Stephen shook it briefly. Then, with a look of distaste, wiped his hand down his dressing gown.
You look a bit grubby, lad. Where have you been?
Sarah explained the situation, her father becoming more alarmed the further into Adam's story she went.
Don't you think this should be a matter for the police?
He asked.
He's only 15, you say?
Sarah touched his arm. Give him a chance, Dad. Adam's going to get himself cleaned up, and then he's going to call his mum.
Well, let's hope we don't go down for harbouring a criminal.
Dad, for God's sake, you're overreacting as usual. Just let me handle it, okay?
Well, if you're sure you've...
The ringing of the telephone halted his reply.
I'll be back in a minute,
he said, making his way to the hall. Sarah turned to Adam. Don't worry about him. He can be a little, unreasonable. Adam laughed.
You don't need to tell me about unreasonable parents. I wrote the book.
It'll be all right, you know. Trust me. She nodded towards the hall.
When he's finished on the phone, you can call her. He wrinkled his nose.
I don't know. Will you do it?
What's happened to that confident young man I met in the asylum? The one who's managed to survive on the streets for the past 8 months? He looked defeated.
That was Nathan.
Come here. She pulled him close and squeezed him hard, rubbing her hand up and down his back, then pushed him away so she could look into his face.
Okay, I'll call her, but you have to speak to her.
But... She put a finger to his lips. But nothing. I could just be some lunatic phoning up out of the blue as far as she's concerned. You have to speak to her. He folded his arms, beaten but still belligerent.
Fine, you win. I'll do it.
They both turned as they heard the door brush across the carpet, and Stephen re-entered the room. His face was colourless, his jaw slack, and a scrap of paper fluttered in his hands.
Dad?
Exclaimed Sarah. What's the matter? Is it bad news? She rushed to his side.
That was the agency,
he began.
They found him.
His face cracked into a broad smile, the crow's feet around his eyes deepening.
They found my boy.
But that's wonderful, Dad. I mean, is he okay? Where is he? What's his name? He eased himself down into a chair and handed her the piece of paper.
His name is Joseph.
Sarah turned to Adam. Isn't it marvellous? Adam? She looked at her father. Where's he gone? She heard his voice coming from the hall and popped her head round the door. His back was turned and he was leaning his forehead against the mirror, the phone pressed to his ear.
I'm fine, Mum. Honest. Stop crying, will you?
He straightened up, saw Sarah watching him and gave her a small smile.
Thank you,
he mouthed. She winked at him.
You're welcome.
She returned to her father and sat on the arm of the chair.
Well, Dad?
She kissed his head.
What are you going to do now?
Chapter 57. He would have preferred to drive himself. 200 miles with nothing to do but think, reflect and plan. It was so frustrating, not to mention demeaning having to rely on his daughter to drive him long distances. Sarah was insistent, though, intransigent even, and he knew that arguing with her was futile. She was so stubborn. He couldn't imagine where she got it from. He looked across at her in the driving seat, hands gripping the wheel in concentration as the car bounced along the bumpy lane. The hedgerows were coming to life, the thorny twigs now abundant with frothy blossom, birds darting in and out as they collected twigs and bits of sheep wool. How are you feeling, Dad? Instead of an automatic response, he actually considered the question. It was one he had asked of other people countless times in his professional career. He brought the bouquet of flowers up to his nose and inhaled their sweet perfume.
Apprehensive, but excited too,
he concluded. I really think you ought to have phoned first.
Yes, so you said, but I'm not doing this over the phone. I owe her that much.
She swung the car round a bend and Amy's cottage came into view. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes.
Can you give me a couple of hours?
Hadn't you better see if she's in first? He looked at the pale blue front door, wide open, Jess sleeping across the threshold.
She's in.
Sarah brought the car to a halt but left the engine running. Good luck then, Dad. He unhooked the latch on the gate, immediately alerting the dog to his presence. She looked up and sprang to her feet.
Hello, Jess,
he said, pulling on her silky ears.
Where's Amy, then?
Jess circled round him, her tail whipping across his knees. He tapped on the front door and called into the empty hall.
Amy, are you in there?
There was no response. He tried again, a little louder. Nothing. Clutching the bouquet to his chest, he made his way round to the back of the cottage, stopping abruptly as he saw her familiar figure. She had her back to him, stretching up to throw a sheet over the washing line. It flapped around on the breeze and she struggled to peg it into place. Her long silver hair trailed almost to her waist, and her slight frame could have belonged to a teenager instead of a woman who had not long since turned 70.
"Do you need a hand?"
he called. She swiveled round, her brown eyes opening wide.
"Stephen?"
He moved towards her, holding out the flowers.
"Hello, Amy."
She took them from him, instinctively bowing her head to inhale the scent.
"What? I mean, why?"
Her expression was one of confusion, her forehead creased, a questioning look in her eyes. She seemed vulnerable, and all at once he longed to take her in his arms, smooth her hair and whisper reassurances into her ear. The repressed feelings he'd had for her half a century ago bubbled to the surface again. How different her life would have been if he hadn't been such a coward. Because of his selfish actions, she'd spent her best years locked away. He could never make it up to her.
"Stephen?"
He nodded towards a wooden bench green with moss.
"Can we sit for a while?"
He followed her to the bench and sat down next to her.
"Amy,"
he began, picking up her hand.
"The English language has yet to come up with a word to adequately express how very sorry I am. You captivated me all those years ago, right from the moment I saw you, in fact."
He gave a small laugh.
"But I'm a psychiatrist. I didn't believe in love at first sight. Never mind that you were embedded in my every waking thought. I took this to mean I was infatuated, but not in love. I was wrong."
"You didn't know about the baby then, though, did you?" He shook his head.
"No, I didn't. But I ran away from my feelings for you, and that was unforgivable."
She reached out and touched his cheek.
"You look so sad, Stephen. Don't be too hard on yourself."
She stood up and held out her hand.
"Let's go inside, shall we? I assume you've not come all this way for nothing."
He heaved himself off the bench, his arthritic knees audibly complaining as he stood. He placed his hand in the small of his back as he straightened up and faced her.
"No. There's a very good reason for my visit. I wanted to see you in person, to be here for you when I delivered the news."
"Oh." The word fluttered out on a sigh.
Is it about our baby?"
He nodded slowly.
"He's been found, Amy. Our boy has been found."
She grabbed hold of his lapel.
"Honestly, you mean it?"
He reached into his inside pocket and pulled out a photograph.
"Here he is. That's our son."
She stared at the picture, blinking away the tears. He was sitting in an armchair, staring directly into the lens, a broad beam across his face. His hairline was receding, giving the impression of a large forehead, and he carried a little too much weight around his middle. Behind the thick-framed glasses, his eyes sparkled with obvious affection for whoever had taken the photograph. His wife, perhaps, or maybe one of his children.
"He looks happy,"
she declared, flicking the tears from her cheeks.
"He looks really happy."
Stephen placed his arm around her shoulders.
"You're shaking, Amy. Let's get you inside."
He pulled her close, supporting her weight as they made their way into the kitchen.
"What did they call him?"
she asked, still staring at the picture.
"Joseph. But I believe he's known as Joe."
"Can I see him?"
"If you're sure that's what you want, we can put the wheels in motion."
He paused to steady his voice.
"And if you don't mind, I'd like to come with you."
She pressed the photograph to her chest and closed her eyes.
"I'd like that, Stephen. I'd like that very much."
Chapter 58. As the train slid silently into Piccadilly Station, Amy gathered up the detritus from the table in front of her. For the past 6.5 hours, she'd shared the company of a young mother and her 3-year-old twin girls. Amy had marvelled at the amount of patience the woman had shown as she wiped noses, read storybooks, coloured in endless pictures and made several journeys to the toilet. Now the twins leaned against each other, their eyes closed, pink cheeks aglow from the heat of the carriage.
"Bless them," Amy said. "They're a credit to you. They really are."
The young mother stopped clearing away and beamed at her daughters.
"Look at them. Fast asleep, now it's time to get off. Typical. They'll be excited to see their father, I expect."
"Oh, yes, daddy's girls they are. Still, it'll give me a break, or at least a chance to get all this washing done."
She heaved down her suitcase. "It was really nice meeting you, Amy, and good luck with everything."
She watched as the three of them stepped off the train, the little girls holding hands and yawning as they tottered along the platform. Amy waited until the other passengers had gone before she retrieved her own suitcase. The brown leather was battered and worn, the stitching around the handle frayed, but this case had history, and she would never part with it. Everybody else seemed to have anonymous black cases with handles you pulled out and little wheels on the bottom, cases that were forever tripping people up or crashing into their ankles. Amy shook her head. No, they wouldn't do for her. She was more than happy with her battered brown one. She made her way along the platform towards the glass doors, amazed at the number of people milling around in the middle of the day. Didn't they have jobs to go to? They were standing exactly where they said they would be, next to the circular information booth, the electronic timetable suspended above their heads. Stephen saw her first and moved towards her, arms outstretched.
"Hello, Amy. Welcome back."
He kissed her on both cheeks. How very continental. When did all that start, she wondered.
"Hello again, Amy," greeted Sarah, giving her a swift embrace. "Here," offered Stephen. "Let me take your case. How was your journey?" "It was long, but I shared a table with a delightful family. The mother had taken her twins to Wales to visit their grandmother, and they were on their way home."
She smiled fondly.
"They were a handful, those two, I can tell you, but they made the journey fly by."
"I would have come to fetch you," said Sarah.
"Nonsense, I was fine. You've enough on your plate without worrying about an old dear like me."
She looked Sarah up and down.
"There's something different."
"Oh," replied Sarah, self-consciously running her fingers through her bob. "It's the hair. Thought I'd try something new." Amy nodded her approval.
"It suits you."
Stephen took her elbow and guided her towards the exit.
"Come on, the hotel's just a few hundred yards away."
"Bye then," said Sarah.
"Aren't you coming with us?"
asked Amy. "No, I'm meeting someone. I'll see you later."
"Oh?"
said Amy, making it sound like a question.
"How lovely. Is it a young man?"
Sarah laughed.
"Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. Now, go on, you two. Enjoy yourselves. I'll see you later."
Sarah waited outside the main doors, the sunshine now warm enough to make her jacket redundant. She stared at the old man sitting cross-legged on the pavement, one arm slung around his dog's neck, the other hand clutching a polystyrene cup. She wandered over and dropped a freshly minted £2 coin into it. The dog looked at her, its doleful eyes and grey muzzle reflecting its owner's pitiful state.
"Ta,"
muttered the beggar.
"I'm grateful to you."
She crouched down next to him. "Are you hungry?" He smiled, his lack of teeth giving him a manic look.
"Always."
"I'll be back in a minute." She returned with a piping hot pasty and watched him as he took a bite, then broke off a small piece for the dog. She swiveled round as she heard her name.
"Sarah? Hi!"
Had he not called out to her, she would not have recognised him. She could have passed him on the street and not had an inkling as to who he was. His blonde hair was even lighter, the long fringe now coiffed into a neat wave, and his once pallid skin sported a healthy tan. Although he would always be a skinny lad, he had filled out a little, his defined biceps suggesting he'd paid more than a few visits to the gym.
"Adam! Oh, it's so good to see you again!"
She held out her arms and pulled him towards her.
He smelled clean, the delicious aroma of freshly laundered clothes.
You too, he replied. I like your hair. And you look so thin. I mean, in a good way. Not that you were ever fat before, but now you...
Thank you, Adam, she laughed. I do feel much better.
He turned to the woman beside him. Sarah, this is my mom, Geraldine.
She bore no resemblance to the woman Sarah had seen in the newspaper article. Gone were the haunted eyes and hollowed-out cheeks, the telltale signs of someone who was suffering an agonizing wait for news of her only son. Sarah held out her hand. I'm pleased to meet you at last. Geraldine's moist palms gave away her nervousness.
I don't know what to say, Sarah, except thank you. Thank you for taking care of my boy and for bringing him back to me.
She ran a finger along her eyelid, leaving a long, dark smudge.
I can't bear to imagine what would have happened to him if he hadn't met you.
Mom, Adam warned. You promised not to get all soppy. Adam's a fine young man, Geraldine, said Sarah. Geraldine pulled her son closer.
We've had a lot to resolve, but we're getting there. Adam's at the high school with all his mates now and doing really well.
And we don't focus too much on the academic stuff, do we, Mom? There are other things that are important too.
He pursed his lips and gave a slight shake of his head in Sarah's direction. She detected his exasperated tone and gave him a knowing smile. Come on, I've booked a table at a restaurant with a roof terrace so we can enjoy the sunshine.
Adam pulled out a chair for his mother and she slid gracefully into it. Sitting opposite and from behind the protection of her sunglasses, Sarah was able to study the other woman. From what Adam had told her, she must only be in her early 30s, and the former wild child who had found herself pregnant at the age of 15 had certainly matured into a sophisticated woman. Her raven hair fell in bouncy waves which rested on her shoulders. Her makeup was immaculately applied, with no hint of shine in spite of the heat. Her dark ruby lips only served to accentuate the whiteness of her teeth. Whilst Geraldine exuded effortless glamour, Sarah felt as though she herself was melting in the heat. She picked up the napkin and surreptitiously dabbed at her damp forehead, then called to a passing waitress.
A bottle of champagne, please, and 3 glasses.
Geraldine looked up from the menu.
Are we celebrating something?
You'll see. Do you mind if Adam has a sip of champagne?
Oh, said Adam, rubbing his hands together. My first alcoholic drink.
Geraldine stared at him, her heavily cold eyes narrowing.
No need to be sarcastic, Adam.
Sarah rummaged in her handbag and pulled out a brown paper bag. She passed it across the table to Adam.
What's this?
Open it. Adam peered into the bag, then reached in and pulled out the book. He stared at the glossy cover and the title in large white letters. Ambergate, A Personal History.
Wow, this is cool, Sarah. I can't believe you actually finished it. Well done.
Well, it's self-published, but it's available online and my local bookshop has agreed to stock it. And, of course, there's a copy in the library. I can't see me troubling the Times bestseller list, but that was never really the point. Adam passed it to his mother.
Isn't it brilliant?
Geraldine smoothed her fingers over the photograph of Ambergate.
It certainly is, she said quietly. Congratulations.
Turn to the back page, urged Sarah. Geraldine read from the acknowledgements.
My special thanks go to Adam Clark. Our serendipitous meeting proved to be a turning point for both of us. I'm incredibly fortunate to count him as a friend.
Geraldine turned to Adam.
Isn't that lovely, son?
The colour had risen in his cheeks.
Jeez, Sarah, you're a soft one.
He reached across the table and touched her hand, his eyes smiling.
But thank you.
Chapter 59.
How's your room?
Inquired Stephen as he pulled the chair out for her. Amy tucked her skirt beneath her and sat down, spreading the napkin out on her lap.
Oh, it's marvellous. It has a great big bed, wide enough for a family of 4, and all these pillows and cushions. And there's a little fridge tucked away in a cupboard with tiny bottles of whiskey and gin and wine. Stephen took the chair opposite, watching her with quiet amusement.
You sound like you've never stayed in a hotel before,
he laughed.
Well, I haven't.
She looked down and fidgeted with the napkin. He reached across the table and laid his hand over hers.
I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking. Let's order some wine, shall we? Red or white?
She shrugged.
Why don't you choose?
He perused the wine list, holding it under the light of the candle.
It's so bloody dark in here, I can't read a thing.
He beckoned a waitress over.
We'll have a bottle of the Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, please.
What's the plan for tomorrow, then, Stephen? Amy wrinkled her nose, still finding it odd calling him by his first name.
I've arranged to meet them in the Pavilion Cafe in the park. I thought neutral territory was a good idea.
You make it sound like we're at war with them.
Not at all. It'll be more relaxed this way. Nobody worrying about whether they've made the tea too strong or not put out the right biscuits.
The waitress returned with a bottle, uncorked it and stood with one hand behind her back as she turned to Amy. Would you like to try the wine, madam? Amy hesitated.
Oh, I don't know much about wine.
Stephen gestured dismissively with his hand.
Just pour it. Well, that was rude,
declared Amy after the waitress had gone. Stephen looked genuinely perplexed.
Was it? You haven't changed one bit. Do you possess any self-awareness at all? I remember you used to terrify some of the patients and the staff.
Nonsense. They loved me.
They were in awe of you, more like.
She picked up her glass and swirled the wine around, then leaned in and lowered her voice.
Everybody wanted to please you. Everybody wanted you to like them. And you revelled in their fawning.
She leaned back in her chair, waiting for her assessment of him to sink in.
You were responsible for so many lives in there, and I don't think you used that power wisely.
She tipped her head back and stared at the ceiling.
So many people locked away for years on end, and without good reason. People that you certified, Dr. Lambourne.
She dabbed at her eyes with the napkin.
I watched so many of my friends just wither and die.
We lived in different times, Amy. I was a victim of the system too.
She ignored his protest.
Do you remember Pearl?
He nodded.
The big girl with the moon face.
How many times did she beg you to let her go home?
When he didn't respond, she supplied the answer.
Countless times, Stephen. She pleaded with you to let her out. You'd diagnosed her as a mental defective and feeble-minded.
She threw her hands in the air.
What does that even mean?
It means that...
Stop it, Stephen! It wasn't enough to keep her locked up for life, and you know it. She'd been jilted at the altar by the only man she'd ever loved. She was broken-hearted. That was all. There was nothing wrong with her mind. At least there wasn't when she was admitted. And the others too, Belinda, Queenie, all of them just left to rot away. I never thought I'd say it, but I was one of the lucky ones. At least I made it out in the end.
Unable to meet her stare, he laid his palms on the table and studied the back of his hands.
You're right, Amy. You're absolutely right.
His demeanour had changed to that of a broken man, one who had realised there was nothing he could do to rectify the mistakes of the past. A sudden rush of pity for him made her relent.
You could have made me happy, you know. If there was one person who could have done that, it was you.
It's not too late.
She gave a laugh, but there was no humour in it.
Oh, it is, Stephen. It's far too late.
He took a bread roll out of the basket in the middle of the table, breaking it over his plate and spreading it with butter. She noticed how his hands trembled and wondered whether it was nerves or just another symptom of old age. He would be 80 later this month, almost 10 years older than she was. The age gap didn't seem to matter so much now.
"What are you thinking about?"
he asked. She shook her head to clear the memories. "Oh, just how different things could have been, that's all."
"Please, Amy, I..."
"It's all right, Stephen.
I've forgiven you. Holding on to all that bitterness, that regret, the anger, well, it's like holding your breath. It ends up suffocating you. I had to let it go."
She took another gulp of her wine. Already she was beginning to feel hot and light-headed, the back of her neck damp beneath the weight of her hair. She fanned herself with the menu.
"You've redeemed yourself, Dr. Lamborn."
She raised her glass.
"And tomorrow, thanks to you, I will meet my son. It may be 50 years too late, but I'll always be grateful to you for that."
Chapter 60. They chose a table outside in the warm May sunshine, shaded by a huge umbrella. Signs of summer were everywhere. The abundant dark purple flowers of the clematis tumbled over the wall, and the scent of freshly mown grass wafted around the courtyard. Stephen pulled a chair out for Amy.
"Thank you,"
she said, lowering herself into it and removing her sunglasses. She had agonized about what to wear for days, not that she had a great deal to choose from. She led a simple existence, and clothes were not something she gave much thought to, usually pulling on the first thing to hand each morning. Years in Ambergate wearing the shapeless communal dresses had not exactly forged an interest in fashion.
"You look lovely, Amy,"
ventured Stephen.
"That colour really suits you."
She smoothed her hand down the lilac blouse.
"Thanks. I wasn't sure what to go for."
She had pulled her hair into a chignon, leaving just a few strands loose to soften her face. Stephen had chosen a casual look, his pale pink checked shirt open at the neck, his face clean-shaven and the scent of sandalwood clinging to his skin.
"I think you've got it just right,"
he smiled. He squinted at his watch.
"Not long to go now."
Amy spotted them first and nudged Stephen, and they rose from their seats together to greet them. She could hardly breathe, let alone speak, her mouth a dry cave from which no words would come. She held on to the table for support as she stared at the woman who had become the mother to her own son. Jean introduced herself to Stephen and he shook her hand warmly.
"Thank you for coming. You've no idea what this means to us."
Amy hovered behind, happy to let Stephen do the talking. Jean was a small woman with a slender frame, almost bird-like, and a bubble of freshly permed grey hair tinged with blue. Two spots of blusher accentuated her cheekbones, and a slick of pink lipstick showed she had made an effort. She had a kind face that even in repose held a smile. Stephen turned and introduced Amy. Dispensing with a formal handshake, Amy leaned in and gave the older woman a hug, finding comfort in the powdery scent of her skin. Jean returned the embrace, and the two women stood locked together until Stephen touched Amy lightly on the shoulder. Jean smiled and kissed Amy on the cheek.
"I'd like to introduce you to Joe."
Amy gazed at her son, the boy she thought had died all those years ago. The boy she believed had been chucked into a coffin with someone else and not even afforded the respect of his own gravestone. The boy, they told her, had not taken a single breath. For most of her life, she had tortured herself with the notion that she was responsible in some way, that she had not pushed hard enough during the birth or not insisted that the midwife spend longer trying to revive him. Jean bent down so that she was level with her son's face. She patted him on the knee.
"Joe, this is Amy and Stephen."
He rolled his head against the back of his wheelchair and gave a small grunt, his mouth stretching into a smile.
He lifted his arm, his wrist bent at an awkward angle, and moved it from side to side. Jean squeezed his hand.
There's a good boy.
She pulled a handkerchief out of her sleeve and wiped his mouth, before kissing him on the top of his head. Then she smiled at Amy, her chest inflating with pride as she held onto her son's hand.
He's non-verbal, but he understands a lot, so you can talk to him.
Stephen had briefed her about Joe's condition, so she was prepared for the sight of him in his wheelchair and the involuntary movement he was unable to control. What she was unprepared for was the sudden, overwhelming rush of affection she felt for him. He had the same olive complexion as his father, but he had her eyes, huge and fawn-like. She wanted to scoop him up and never let him go. She crouched down in the same way Jean had done, and took hold of his hand.
I'm very pleased to meet you, Joe.
Stephen moved a couple of chairs out of the way, and Jean slid Joe's wheelchair up to the table. She leaned down to talk to him.
Would you like some cake, Joe? They've got chocolate cake, your favourite.
Joe rocked his head back and forth, his eyes shining with excitement. Jean laughed.
Chocolate it is, then.
After giving their orders to the waitress, Stephen clasped his hands together and leaned forward.
I was so sorry to hear about your husband,
he said to Jean. She turned and gazed at her son.
It's hit Joe harder, to be honest. He doted on his dad and Harold was marvellous with him. Joe just cannot understand where he's gone. He cried for him every night for 2 weeks afterwards.
She sniffed.
It tore me apart.
And how is he now?
Asked Stephen.
It's been almost a year since we lost Harold, and Joe is calmer now. He no longer cries himself to sleep, but I worry that he's forgotten him, or worse, that he thinks Harold's just abandoned him.
She smoothed her hand over Joe's hair.
It's difficult to know what's going on in there. Harold sounds like a wonderful father, said Amy.
Jean smiled fondly.
He was the best father Joe could have had.
She stopped and looked apologetically at Stephen.
No offence.
Stephen raised his palm.
None taken.
Joe began to move his arms up and down like an excited toddler, banging them on the arms of his chair. He made a low moaning sound in his throat as he turned his head.
What is it, Joe, love?
Jean asked gently, following his gaze.
Oh, he's seen the cat. Joe loves animals, don't you, lad?
Amy rose from her seat to where the smoky grey cat sat in a puddle of sunshine, licking its chest. She picked it up, and it rubbed its face against the underside of her chin. She carried it over to Joe and laid it in his lap. Joe's features lifted as he clumsily patted the animal, a wide grin on his face. The waitress returned with a tray laden with food. A three-tiered serving plate was crammed full of dainty crustless sandwiches and tiny pastel-coloured cupcakes. Joe spotted the huge slice of chocolate cake and waved his arms excitedly as the cat leapt off his knee. Amy reached for the teapot, lifted the lid and gave it a stir. She picked it up and looked round the table.
Shall I be mother?
She stopped, at once wishing she could take back her crass words. Her son might be sitting opposite, but she had never felt less like a mother. Jean unfolded a napkin and laid it across Joe's knee. She cut the chocolate cake into small pieces and popped one into Joe's mouth. He made an appreciative noise and opened his mouth wide like a baby bird awaiting a worm.
You can do the next one, Joe.
She opened up his palm and dropped a piece of cake into it. Joe brought his hand up and squashed the cake into his mouth.
Good boy, Joe,
praised Jean.
Well done.
He held his hand out for another piece, but this time Jean handed him the plate.
You pick up the next one.
Joe shook his head, but Jean steadfastly held the plate in front of him.
Go on, Joe,
she said firmly. Amy watched in agony. It seemed cruel to her making him pick up the little bits of cake when he obviously had trouble with his fine motor skills. But Jean was immovable, and eventually Joe leaned forward and picked up a piece of cake with his thumb and forefinger. He squeezed too hard, though, and the cake all but disintegrated between his fingers. He managed to shovel only a few crumbs into his mouth, but Jean applauded with obvious delight.
"I knew you could do it!"
She leaned over and kissed him on the forehead.
"I love you, you clever lad."
Joe smiled at her and patted his chest 3 times.
"That's Joe's sign for I love you,"
Jean explained.
"Harold taught him that."
At Stephen's suggestion, they took a walk around the ornamental gardens, Stephen pushing Joe's wheelchair, Amy and Jean lagging some distance behind. The two women stopped beside a fountain, a cast-iron fish spewing water out of its mouth, the pool beneath littered with coins now turning green. Amy rummaged in her pocket and tossed in a 10-pence piece. She closed her eyes for a second, breathing in deeply, the scent of the nearby lavender bushes filling her nostrils.
"Can I ask you something, Jean?" "You can ask me anything you want, but I'll not promise to know the answer." "Why did you choose my baby?"
Jean smiled and shook her head.
"I didn't love it. He chose me."
Amy indicated the stone bench beside the fountain.
"Do you mind if we sit for a while?"
Stephen was up ahead, bending down next to Joe's chair, guiding his hand to stroke an overexcited golden retriever.
"Of course. Tell me about Joe, please,"
said Amy.
"Everything from the beginning."
She noticed Stephen turning round and starting to manoeuvre Joe's wheelchair in their direction. She shook her head and waved him away. He nodded his understanding.
"Joe was 6 weeks old when we first saw him,"
Jean began.
"Harold and I had never been able to have children, so we decided to adopt. There was no shortage of babies back then. Young mothers who got pregnant out of wedlock were encouraged, dare I say, forced to give their babies up. They were herded into mother and baby homes, and after they had given birth, they were allowed to keep their babies for 6 weeks. That's the part I found particularly barbaric, giving them time to bond with their little ones and then just snatching them away. It seemed cruel to me, and I didn't feel comfortable taking another woman's child against her will. Then I saw Joe, lying in his cot, just staring up at the ceiling. His eyes were huge and so dark, I was captivated immediately. I asked one of the nurses about him, and she told me he wasn't to be adopted because he was retarded."
She glanced at Amy.
"I'm sorry, but that's the word they used back then. I asked what was to become of him, and the nurse said he would be put away."
Amy covered her mouth with her hand.
"Put away? My God, how callous."
Quite,
agreed Jean.
"I felt sick to think of this tiny, helpless baby who had no one and was going to be shoved into some kind of institution because he was an inconvenience who had no place in society and needed to be kept out of sight. I couldn't have lived with myself if I'd just turned my back and walked away. I reached down into his cot and touched his cheek. His eyes widened as though he was shocked at this basic human contact. And then his little lips stretched into a crooked smile and he kicked his legs. I looked up at my husband. I didn't even need to say anything. He nodded his head and I bent down and scooped Joe up. The nurse came running then, all of a fluster she was, and demanded I put him back. But it was too late. He'd already stolen my heart. And I knew I wasn't leaving that place without him."
Amy's tears rolled off the end of her chin and landed on her blouse, leaving a dark stain.
"That's so beautiful, Jean."
She glanced along the path to where Stephen was tending to Joe, pulling his hat down to shield his eyes from the sun.
"What a terrible life he'd have had if you and Harold hadn't come along.
I've never heard anything so selfless in all my life. I don't know how I can ever thank you.
Oh, no, I don't need any thanks, Amy. Joe has enriched our lives far more than we have enriched his. I'm right proud to call myself his mother.
You've done a far better job with him than I could ever have done, admitted Amy.
Don't be so hard on yourself, love. You were never even given the chance.
Amy turned her face up to the pale sunshine, rolling back the years in her mind. She had never been insane. She'd been traumatized by witnessing her mother's death at such an early age. That was when her life had begun to implode. Even now, she could pinpoint the exact second. The image of her mother's broken body spread-eagled across the bonnet of that car was as sharp today as it had been 60 years ago. She hadn't been allowed to attend the funeral, nor cry in front of her father for fear of upsetting him. She'd been forced to repress her feelings, put on a brave face and quietly smother the grief that threatened to swallow her whole.
Amy, are you all right? You look awfully pale.
Jean's soft voice brought her back to the present.
I wasn't mad, you know. I should never have been locked away like that.
She held her hands up.
Oh, I admit I was probably a handful, and attacking another patient with a piece of broken crockery certainly didn't help convince them that I should be allowed out into the wider community. But they turned me into someone I wasn't. After my baby died... After they told me my baby had died, I think I just gave up. I had nothing left to go on for.
She nodded towards Stephen.
And he had left me. He left you when you were pregnant. He didn't know I was carrying his child. It was complicated. I was a detained mental patient. He was my doctor. You can see how that might be difficult.
Jean seemed doubtful.
Even so, to just abandon you like that.
I've forgiven him, Jean, she said simply. I had to.
Jean twisted the handle of her bag in her fingers, a frown registering her concern.
Do you know what I fret about most, Amy? Especially now that Harold's gone and it's just me and Joe.
Amy nodded.
What's going to happen to him when you're no longer around?
Exactly that,
Jean confirmed.
I've seen the way he's been since Harold died. The confusion on his face when we sit down for a meal and it's just the two of us. I remember the first time I tried to shave him. He fought me like some kind of wild animal, and I ended up nicking his skin. Joe put his fingers to his face and felt the blood. He became hysterical and looked at me as though I'd tried to kill him. Shaving him had always been Harold's job, you see. How is he going to understand it when I've gone? And there's no one to reassure him, eh? I'm 82, for goodness sake.
He's got me now, Jean. I'll be here for him.
I know you mean well, Amy, but you know spring chicken yourself.
Amy managed a laugh.
True. I can't argue with that.
Harold and I have never had much in the way of money. I've never worked because caring for Joe is a full-time job. Not that I'm complaining, you understand. It's been a privilege, and I wouldn't change a thing.
The sound of Joe's wheelchair crunching on the gravel made them both turn around. Stephen's face was crimson with the effort of pushing the chair, his forehead shiny with sweat. He took out his handkerchief and dabbed at his brow.
Phew, it's thirsty work, is this? Here's my boy,
greeted Jean as Joe held out his arms towards his mother. She leaned in to give him a cuddle.
Your face looks a bit red, Joe. I hope you've not had too much sun.
She delved into her handbag and pulled out a small tube of sun cream, then squeezed some into her palm and smoothed it over Joe's face. She closed his eyes and his body relaxed,
his jerky movements quietened as he succumbed to his mother's gentle touch.
"You're so good with him,"
Amy observed.
"You don't need to hear him say it to know that he adores you."
Jean sat back and gazed at her son.
"He's everything to me,"
she said simply.
"Jean,"
Amy hesitated.
I'd really like to be a part of Joe's life. If that's all right with you, that is.
Jean looked from Amy to Stephen, then to her son, his face bright and expectant, as though he knew the importance of the answer.
"Joe and I would like that,"
she replied eventually.
"We'd like that very much."
Sarah stared up at the building where it had all begun. The bulldozers had certainly done a thorough job. All that remained of Ambergate was the Grade 2 listed front entrance, the clock tower now restored to its former glory and looking resplendent against the cloudless sky. She studied the billboard. "Coming soon, Ambergate Village, a stunning collection of luxury apartments and sumptuous five-bedroom detached homes." Matt stood behind her and placed his hands on her shoulders.
"Fancy one?"
It was an intimate gesture, and she instinctively leaned back into his chest.
"Never. I know far too much about what went on in this place. I'd never sleep at night." "Come on, show me around."
"Well, there's not much left, really." She pointed across the lawn. "That's the little chapel where the patients used to pray. It seems to have escaped the bulldozers. And over there is where the cricket field used to be." She sighed as she thought about Amy and her wasted life.
"I'm just glad I didn't take any notice of my father when he ordered me to stop snooping around. If I'd listened to him, Amy would never have been reunited with her son."
"You did the right thing,"
Matt confirmed.
"And your book is wonderful. I'm so proud of you."
He pulled her into a fierce bear hug, one that was usually reserved for good friends rather than lovers.
"Matt," she asked tentatively.
What is this?"
He frowned. "You've lost me."
"This, you and me. I need to know how you feel because as fond as I am of Maisie, if you're just looking for a mother figure for her, then I'm afraid..."
He cupped her face in his hands, silencing her with a tender kiss on the lips.
She closed her eyes as she felt his fingers work their way into her hair. He pulled away and locked his gaze on hers as he stroked her cheek.
"Does that answer your question?"
She nodded.
"Things are a little clearer now, yes."
"Come on,"
he whispered.
"It's nearly time to pick Maisie up from school."
Sarah frowned. "I don't think so. Doesn't she have art club on Tuesdays?" Matt smacked his forehead.
"Oh, you're right."
He took hold of her hand.
"Whatever would we do without you?"
She stood on her tiptoes and kissed him again.
"Well, hopefully you'll never have to find out."
Epilogue.
The room is stuffy and airless. The smells of old furniture, mothballs and body odour combine to make me feel slightly nauseous. A woman on the other side of the room takes hold of a long pole and opens a window high up on the wall. It won't make much difference. The air outside is hot and sticky too. There's not a breath of wind to cool the rising temperature. I stand at the back and stare over the heads of the people seated in the rows in front of me, fanning themselves with whatever they have to hand. My gaze travels along the wall to the front, where my son is sitting in his wheelchair. He catches me looking at him, and gives me a wide grin. 2 years have passed since I found him, and it's fair to say that we've become friends. I've accepted that is all we'll ever be, for I can never be his mother. His mother is the person standing behind him now, smoothing his hair and wiping his glistening chin. I watch as she massages his shoulders and absently bends down to kiss his head. I give thanks every day to whoever might be listening that this selfless woman chose my son. starved of oxygen for so long at birth, he never stood a chance. He's never learned to walk or talk. And but for Jean and Harold, he would have spent his life in an institution. The irony is not lost on me, and I feel physically sick at the thought of him languishing in a home with nobody to love him. And Jean most definitely loves him. But she is not getting any younger. Widowed for 3 years now, she's 84 herself. The future for Joe looks uncertain. The auctioneer bangs his gavel down so hard it makes me jump. He adjusts his half-moon spectacles and points to a man on the front row.
Sold to the gentleman on my right for £5,550. Thank you, sir.
He clears his throat and adjusts his paisley bow tie.
Now we come to lot number 28.
There are a few rumblings before a hush descends on the room.
Lot number 28 represents a rare opportunity to acquire a painting by the gifted artist Millie McCarthy.
I stiffen at the mention of my mother, but a feeling of pride swells inside me and I stand taller.
Miss McCarthy sold only a few paintings in her lifetime, but L.S. Lowry recognised her talent, and two of her works were purchased by him for his own private collection.
He gazed over the expectant faces below him.
Now, who will start the bidding? £20,000, anybody?
He pointed to someone at the back of the room.
Thank you, sir. Do I hear? Yes, madam? £20,500, thank you.
He stopped and turned to a woman behind him, her neck flushed with excitement. She held up three fingers. He turned back to the audience.
I have 30,000 on the phone. Any advance? Yes, thank you. I have 40,000 down here.
He nodded to his left and raised his eyebrows.
£50,000.
My head starts to pound, and sweat prickles my armpits. I waft the catalogue in front of my face as the years fall away. It is as though I am back in that meadow watching my mother. Her auburn hair is tied back from her face. Her green eyes ablaze with concentration, and her tongue sticking out of the side of her mouth as she sweeps the brush across the canvas. I can hear myself asking her to paint me. My childish voice full of indignation when she tells me no. Then she scoops me up onto her knee and tickles my ribs. I squirm with laughter as she nuzzles into my neck and tells me she will paint me into the picture, but I mustn't tell anyone. It's to be our secret. I had never felt so loved as I did that day. And I remember thinking I had the best mummy in all the world. The auctioneer's gavel startles me again, and I'm brought abruptly back to the present.
Sold for £125,000.
He nods to the man still holding up his card.
Congratulations, sir.
I feel myself swaying and grab hold of the chair in front of me, catching the back of the person's head. Sorry, I mumble. Dabbing my forehead with a tissue. I want to laugh, to cry, to shout out to anyone who cares to listen. My son's future is secured. From across the room, Joe catches my eye and smiles. He has no comprehension of what's just happened, but as he looks at me, he pats his chest 3 times. Tears spring to my eyes, blurring my vision. I can never be his mother. But I can be his friend. I return the gesture, whispering the words, I love you too, son. There's the sound of chairs scraping on the floorboards as people stand to leave. Excited chatter breaks out and the crowd begins to disperse. The auction has come to an end. And the story of the troubled young girl who stole a baby and waded into a lake is now at its end too. A young girl who was never evil, never mad or even bad, but who nevertheless had her life stolen. I'm too old now for fairy tale endings. I'm not married to the love of my life. My son has no idea I'm his mother. But it's an ending of sorts. I turn to the exit where Stephen is standing, silhouetted against the bright sunshine outside. He smiles at me and gives me a thumbs-up gesture, mouthing the words, "You okay?" I manage a smile in return and nod my head. He holds out his hand, and I cross the floor to take it. As he steers me out onto the pavement, his arm now circling my body, I realize that I am happy at last. And it's enough.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.